Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Pharmaceutical Commerce Podcast. I'm Nico Saraceno, Associate Editor of PC, and I'm here with Mike Christel, PharmCom's Editorial Director. We are pleased to be joined today by Casey McTeague, Managing Director of Professional Services at SRS Aquium, a company which, among the various sectors that it works with, provides support for life sciences M&A transactions involving pharma, biotech, med devices, and diagnostics. Casey, a lawyer by trade who earned a JD from the UC Berkeley School of Law, will be discussing the key highlights from SRS's recently released Biopharma M&A study. SRS Aquium has provided professional and financial services as a post-closing shareholder representative for sellers on 295 life sciences M&A deals since 2008. Casey, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Nico. Yeah, it's great to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, great to have you, Casey. We appreciate you joining us. So yeah, we'll dive right in. We found the study that your company did on the M&A scene pretty interesting. And of course, pharma commerce, we love to stay on top of what's going on in the M&A space and what's driving today's deal making activity. What we found really interesting, though, was that your study looked at these trends in the M&A, not just at the outset of a deal, but actually years into the acquisition and the integration, particularly when it comes to milestone events and the payments tied to those, the so-called bio dollars. Milestone payments actually increased during the COVID climate, and that milestones continue to appear in a consistent number of pharma deals despite COVID and across all subsectors. Can you share with our audience what you think have been the main drivers of this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The trend started pre-COVID, but certainly COVID didn't slow it down. And if anything, the trend has accelerated. I'd say that probably starting in 2015, but really in the last few years, we've seen an explosion in earnout dollars that are available on these deals. The biggest change has been the long-term earnouts, especially in pharma in particular. So the earnouts that no one expects to be achieved until 7 to 10 years after a deal is closed, that's where we're seeing the biggest growth.
At the same time, you're seeing a lot of this growth. You guys did note to us beforehand when we did a pre-call to get some background that all sales milestones from pre-COVID deals are still at risk because of, there's manufacturing difficulties for commercially available treatments involved in these transactions. There's also development milestones that were significantly delayed due to, factors such as lockdowns, safety issues, site staff illness, reallocation of resources to COVID research. Do you have any insights from the data, on specific pharma subsectors in particular, most impacted by these trends, or maybe just some general perspectives on, some of these challenges as well?
The biggest highlight, obviously, is that all of this is still TBD. We're just getting into what we would call a new normal. Once vaccines started rolling out and new deals started closing in this climate, we're starting to see some different terms. The study has some great data to show that we're not sure how much is going to change. Now, obviously, there's new things like pandemic at material adverse event clauses or different ways of changing the deadlines on earnouts post-closing if there's a pandemic, kind of unique things like that. But what's remained relatively constant, you still see 80% of pharma deals with earnouts. You still see about a third of earnouts being hit overall. You still see disputes in about a quarter of all the deals that we see, which is a significant number. And of those, over half get renegotiated. I think with COVID, you saw the renegotiations and disputes kick up because of the things you're talking about. We had clinical trials all got put on ice for a significant length of time, either because they were actually prohibited from going forward or because they couldn't find patients who were willing to come into the clinic. You had delays on the regulatory side because the FDA was obviously very focused on COVID, sometimes at the expense of other programs that it didn't put quite a high priority on. So that we'll see how it pans out in the next few years. I'm excited to see what the data shows in the next study. Right now, COVID is just starting to bear fruit in terms of what our study can show.
Yeah, I was sort of curious in the context of that. You had mentioned something I thought was interesting. Once milestones are achieved, some of them matter more than others. Which situations, in your experience supporting clients post-closing, generally matter more in these transactions? Earlier milestones, specific sales or development milestones, can you provide any clarity there?
Yeah, it depends. Obviously, every deal is unique. If a company is already submitting an approval to the FDA, then clearly you're going to be pricing that differently. But one thing that we parsed out this year that was different, we haven't had enough data in prior years to do, is take a look at which deals get the biggest value. And what we found, which was actually not what everyone was expecting, is that earnouts are just bigger if the upfront payment is bigger. So for deals over $100 million upfront, those deals have bigger earnouts, which sounds logical, except that we had all assumed that deals closer to a product being launched would be the ones with the bigger dollars at stake, because those are more likely to actually be achieved. But that's not what we saw. Instead, it was just, if it's a hot commodity that people want, then the sellers can negotiate a bigger earnout.
Your analysis on the diligence requirements tied to milestone agreements in M&As caught our eye as well. CRE, or commercially reasonable efforts, continues to be the most common applicable diligence requirement in biopharma deals. Do you see that shifting at all in the future amid a changing drug development landscape?
Well, it is shifting. We'll see how it plays out. It's definitely a more nuanced term, as far as deal terms go now than it was in the past. And when I talk about deal terms, just for those who aren't immersed in M&A all the time, it's every merger deal has a whole bunch of terms in the 50-page contract, and the parties negotiate about those specific terms. So diligence requirements is one of those terms, and it's essentially how hard the buyer has to work with the asset post-closing in order to meet its obligations. And if they don't meet those obligations, then we, as the shareholder rep, may have to sue or otherwise negotiate with them. And commercially reasonable efforts has always been, in our experience, the most common term. But what we've seen over the last 5 years or so is an increase in buyer discretion diligence, which is essentially that the buyer can do whatever it wants with the asset. Now, that can come in a bunch of different forms. There's a bunch of iterations depending on how the parties negotiate it. But when a buyer has expressed discretion, it could just kill the product whenever it determines it needs to, for commercial reasons or otherwise. That said, what we've seen, and the trend, is actually away from one or the other and towards a mix, where it used to be just CRE, and then it moved a little bit towards pure buyer discretion. Now we're seeing most deals have some kind of combination. It might be that the primary indication, the buyer says it'll have commercially reasonable efforts, but then with any backup indications, it has discretion. Or it could be that after the first milestone is achieved, they have discretion after that. It adds nuance to the deal. I think it's helpful as long as the parties negotiate it clearly, because if the provision is just really both sides wanted to have their cake and eat it too, then that runs into disputes later.
Interestingly, Casey, you mentioned that disputes occur in nearly a third of life sciences transactions, that involve earnouts. And of course, there have been more disputes and renegotiations the last couple of years, given COVID. And you kind of outlined those reasons earlier. Are there particular subsectors in the pharma space where these kinds of renegotiations or disputes are taking the most time, or have involved a lot of litigation, or just kind of get drawn out? Anything come to mind?
Well, perhaps most obviously, the courts are just as backed up as everyone else do. Mm. So if we do get into actual litigation, which we have, it takes even longer than it did before to resolve. So those cases are just in their infancy. It was taking 4+ years to resolve a case in court before COVID. So who only knows how long it's going to take now. That said, the toughest ones to renegotiate that we've seen are mostly the ones where a product is still in development, because they have a huge delay for clinical trials. That delay in clinical trials in turn may make the product less valuable to the buyer. So all of a sudden, the buyer's sitting here with a huge milestone obligation, and it may still see some commercial viability for the asset, but not at the level that everybody thought when they negotiated the deal. So then it comes time, the parties have to decide, do we strike a new bargain? Do we have to go into some form of dispute resolution? Ideally, we don't go into court just because it's such a huge money sink for everyone. So what we've tried to do is work with buyers as the shareholder rep on these deals to renegotiate the terms so that they make sense for everybody. And if we can't get to that point, then there are mechanisms in the agreement that you can go to. But it's certainly not the scenario that anybody wants.
I can imagine. Which sort of leads into the kind of next question I had for you. In the case of potential future pandemics, have you noticed disaster provisions being written into put into these milestone agreements more routinely? Have there been some lessons learned in from COVID that could help, structure those agreements going forward?
We have. It's not enough of a trend that I could tell you one way or the other what we'll see a year, 5 years from now, because I think parties are still experimenting with these terms. When you see material adverse event clauses, it might be in the buyer's favor. It might be something like if a pandemic occurs, then the buyer has much more flexibility to terminate development compared to other situations, kind of an exception to the CRE requirement. It could also go in the seller's favor, though. The parties, if the seller has enough leverage, they could insert a clause saying if a pandemic happens, it does not excuse a buyer's diligence obligations, even when it otherwise would. So I can't really say which one is the trend because it's more based on who has the leverage in a particular deal. But I would say that the term has become much more important. Where the parties were not very focused on acts of God provisions before, now it's something that the lawyers are spending a decent amount of time on to try to get to a place where their clients feel safe.
Speaking of which, I feel like that's probably the perfect segue for kind of what I wanted to transition into. I know that you mentioned to us that the post-COVID deals are trying to bake manufacturing and development delays into milestone timing requirements. So given that fact and considering other factors, I know you were getting into the idea of leverage just a moment ago, but given that and other factors, who would you say, I guess from a bit of a general perspective, holds the leverage in these sorts of deals now? And like even moving forward as we try to escape or get out of this post-pandemic, do you see that power dynamic shifting moving forward?
Yeah, it's really in flux. I would say in years past, you could see a clear trend in the buyer's direction or the seller's direction based on markets and things like that. Right now, it really seems to be more company specific from what we see. If that asset appears to be more immune to turbulence, if there's a definite pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, then those sellers hold the keys and can get really good terms. If it's a company that had a pretty high burn rate, their drug or device is still a ways away from netting revenue, then a buyer has a lot more leverage because they're just running out of money. That said, there's also investors that are looking to put cash. So it's hard to really say. I've seen both ways. At this point, it's a little too early in the post-COVID world, and we're not even truly post-COVID yet, to know who has more power. But I'd say right now, if you're at a company and you have a really good asset that you think is a good bet, then you're in a good place right now. I think sellers definitely have leverage in those negotiations.
So beyond the COVID effect, Casey, if you had to take a step back and give a broad perspective of general trends when it comes to M&A that you've noticed in recent years, particularly what seems to be a large rise in mega sales milestones connected to larger deals. How do you account for that?
That's the biggest change that we've seen, is these huge end of life milestones. I think it comes in a couple ways. First, pharma deals are seeing just more earnouts than we used to see. They're occurring at the same rate for deal rates. 80% of pharma deals have an earnout, but there's twice as many earnouts per deal now as we saw, say, 5 years ago. When they're adding those earnouts, a lot of times they're just adding, as you said, a mega sales milestone. And it's really a win-win because the buyer sees that milestone as frankly unlikely to be hit unless they're making so much money that they don't care. And the sellers see it as a way to recoup any potential upside if their drug because it's almost all pharma, does far better than anyone expects. That said, you know, they don't tell us this, but I'm skeptical how many of them think those milestones are going to be achieved. So when you see a press release, the press release talks about total potential earnout consideration. Those numbers are huge. What do they actually expect in terms of percent of that being paid out? Probably something a lot less. So in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see some very different earnout hit rates than we have in this study right now. And I'm pretty excited to see where that goes.
As are we. It's going to be interesting. You mentioned that 5 to 10 year benchmark, I guess, is a good way to kind of measure this. So we really want to thank you for coming on the show, Casey. And who knows, maybe over the next few years, you can come on again and discuss the whole outlook. That'd be great to get your insight on that, perhaps moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. The study comes out every couple of years. Every year, it's gotten better. As you said, we're just about 300 deals now. And that number just is ballooning now that we're on probably the majority of private M&A deals. And it's fun to talk about. Happy to come back anytime. It's the only study like this that can capture stuff post-closing, which is, it's, you know, before we were able to track this data, everybody kind of had their guess on how these deals turn out. And now we're actually getting to see it. So it's really fun to parse that data.
For sure. And yeah, again, Casey, thanks for taking the time. I'm sure our listeners will be able to gather quite a bit of useful content from our chat today. So we're very grateful for having you on. So thanks again.
Thanks, Casey. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And for all you listeners, be sure to stay in the loop of our latest updates via our website at pharmaceuticalcommerce.com or on our SoundCloud page. Take care, everyone.